Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Act and Perspective Podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Simonick. Today's topic is Zen Buddhism and Modern Psychology, a synthesis of the principles of philosophy and practice with Eric Daishin McCabe, a Soto Zen Buddhist priest out of Iowa. Now, Daishin McCabe describes his own personal journey that led to where he is today, starting with his college days as a young student trying to make sense of the world and of his own suffering. We discuss what Zen practice is, why the traditions are so meaningful and important, how he's changed over the years, the challenges he's experienced, and we also get into the philosophical discussion related to the illusion of a separate, independent, free will ego. Now, what's striking are the direct similarities between Zen teaching and the ACT behavioral processes that lead to psychological flexibility. Diffusion, present moment awareness, mindful acceptance of all thoughts and feelings, a fluid sense of self, the value-driven life, and a commitment to action, all wrapped with a focus on compassion, a strong desire to benefit the welfare of others. Anyway, it's one of the longer interviews, but it's well worth it. You can also view this on the Act in Perspective YouTube channel with visuals to help clarify terms and concepts. Now, if you would like to learn more about Soto Zen Buddhist practice, you can go to zenfields.org, where you'll find things like trauma sense of yoga, dharma talks, short meditations, and how you can donate to help promote this work. So without further ado, please help welcome Reverend Eric Daishin McCabe. A lot to learn out there, and I'm beginning. I feel like I'm a beginner.
So, yeah, me too. Yeah, it's not a title. It's just a Dharma name. It's not just a Dharma. It's the name I go by in Dharma contexts.
Okay.
It means great trust or great faith or great confidence. And when I received the five Buddhist precepts early on as a kind of commitment on my behalf to uphold these precepts of cultivating life, generosity, using loving speech, of having faith commitment in relationships, and of nourishing the body and mind. Those are the five precepts. You receive a Dharma name from your teacher, and it's generally something that you need to work on, or something that you are already, or maybe some combination of those two. So great trust or great confidence is something that I need to work on, but something that I also possess.
So why don't you discuss a little bit about your background and how you got involved with Soto Zen Buddhism?
Sure. So I was raised in a household that I would call maybe half Catholic and half agnostic / atheist. And so on one side of the family, there's this kind of strong element of religion, but it wasn't like fundamentalist type religion as much as it's good to go to church, it's good to understand the Bible, it's good to love your neighbor, and it's good to pray. And you don't have to kind of push that on anybody. And on the other side of my family was a sense of, you know, this is, religion is not something that's up to date. It is not in alignment with discoveries of science. And I just don't want to think about it too much. And I'm okay with not knowing, or with maybe there is no God. So that's kind of the mix in my family. And when I went to college, I got a chance to kind of explore religion. I studied religion academically. And that really brought these kind of feelings in the family up to the front of my consciousness, and I could explore them. And when I began to study this philosophy of religion, it just completely blew my mind. My professor, and her name is Carol White, and she at Bucknell University, we were studying these different arguments of whether God exists or not. And there are four traditional arguments that it logically lays out how you can demonstrate that God exists. And you know, coming from a Catholic background, I read these through these arguments on my own, and I thought, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I got it. Mm-hmm. You know, there were arguments like, well, because there is the universe, something or someone must have made the universe. Therefore, we call that God, right? And it seems to be a logical argument, but then when we got into class and started discussing these arguments, they didn't hold up. They didn't hold up from a logical perspective. And for me at that time, in a 20-year-old, 19-year-old body, I couldn't make sense of it. And it threw me off the way that I understood God and religion and my place in the universe. It made me question, is there God, right? Which was something that was actually not too unfamiliar. I didn't realize that at the time, but you know, in one side of my family, this atheist, not agnostic stream was certainly present, but it just came to the fore even more. At that time, it's questioning, oh, does God really exist? Why am I here? If God doesn't exist, that puts a lot of weight on my shoulders, a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. I got to figure this stuff out. I can't rest on somebody else telling me or depend on the goodness of a being that I'm not even sure exists to take care of me. So these are the kind of questions that came up for me. Whether they're the right questions or not, I don't know. But at the time, those were my questions. And I didn't feel comfortable going to a Catholic priest to talk with these about, because I thought that he would generally refer me back to Jesus or the Bible and stuff. And these were questions, you know, I started questioning whether Jesus was God or not. And because I wanted to know, you know, I'm curious. I wanted to know, is this like, what is this? What is the foundation of my faith? And I saw a video of a teacher, John Dido Laurie, who was very instrumental in establishing Zen Mountain Monastery, which is in the Catskills of New York. I saw him giving a video on how to do meditation. And he didn't say anything about God, whether God existed or not existed, wasn't an issue. And he sat still and quiet, and he seemed to be totally at ease with himself. And what I got from him is that his words and his actions were totally in alignment. And I thought at that moment, that's what I want to do. I want to learn how to do that. And shortly afterwards, I learned that there was a teacher, person that came to be my teacher, Diane Banaj, came to the chapel at Bucknell University and was offering Zen meditation. First time I went, I sat down next to her. There was just a couple other people, and I left feeling better than I'd ever felt without having done any drugs or drinking. That's what you do on college campuses. That's what we did. I was in with a pretty big party crowd too, being a swimmer for the university. That's what, you know, you're on a sports team. That's what everybody does. And so you just get swept into that. I didn't realize it at the time. That was creating a lot of anxiety, just, you know, being with a crowd that has as its goal hedonism. But that was it, you know. And you know, but it's just, for me, that was a stage. But then I sat down next to this teacher, and she gave some instruction for how to meditate, and she gave some really helpful advice. And I left feeling better than I'd ever felt without doing anything, you know, and I just sitting there next to her. So it woke me up on a physiological level to another reality that I couldn't explain in words at the time, but I knew I had to keep meditating. And I didn't care whether I was going to be a Buddhist priest or not. In fact, I didn't have any intention of doing that. But I knew I needed to keep doing this practice because it connected me with something very deep inside that I hadn't really had access up to that point, at least in any kind of stable way. So that's how I got into, that was my initial, and then I went to Japan. After I graduated from college, I went to Japan and taught English for a year in Japan. So that got me more into the culture of Japan. I continued to connect with the teacher from Bucknell, from Diane. I did a stint in after that year in Japan, I went to graduate school in California at the GTU, but I didn't last more than a couple of months, more than a semester in graduate school, because here I was, I realized, you know, I could study really high philosophical thoughts and have some ability to write about them, but I couldn't cook a meal for myself. And I felt there was something really wrong with not being able to take care of myself on a very basic level, but having a very high education. And I felt a desire to, and I think it's important to get a good education. No, don't get me wrong. And it's important to think philosophically, but if we don't have the ability to clean our room, to wash our own dishes, and to chop onions and saute them in a frying pan and not burn the place down, I think there's something really wrong there, that, you know, there's some disconnects going on. I feel like home ec should be part of college classes, not just in high school for a certain gender one semester a year. I mean, we need to learn how to take care of ourselves. And so I didn't last very long there. I felt like there's something really missing. I began to teach as a substitute teacher. And that was a very challenging work, but it got me in touch with the real, you know, the people in the community, and I felt like I was closer rather than just studying things in a book. Here I was interacting with people, and that was meaningful to me. You know, being a presence in children's lives, that was important to me. I moved back to Maryland, where I grew up, and I was living with my parents, and I found another job teaching in a Catholic school. And that was probably the one of the most challenging jobs I ever had. I failed miserably at it. It was a good experience because I learned that when you're with a group of 10-year-olds like I was, you know, fifth graders, you've got to have loads of compassion for them. And they don't care. They don't care what, they don't care how smart you are. This is where, you know, having a great education doesn't do us any good when we're with a bunch of 10-year-olds that, you know, they're not there. They only care that you care about them. They want to see some evidence that you love them. You know, you don't have to say I love you, but you have to show it in the way that you are with them. And being at that time, I was 22, 23 years old, I was not mature enough myself to be able to care for 10-year-olds on the level that they needed. But I had great ideas, but those great ideas, they don't get you very far. And I realized, you know, I ended up being forced to resign from the job. So it was very embarrassing to me. And at that time I thought, okay, well, you know, there's something I'm really missing here. And I knew I was missing something when I was out in grad school, but now it's just coming home more. And I need to study with that teacher that I studied with in college. You know, my last year of college, I started practicing meditation with her. I went to a few retreats with her, and I thought, yeah, she's got something, and she speaks to my heart. You know, there's something, it's not a head practice, it's a heart practice. It's a practice that gets you into your heart. And she just spoke to that. And I knew I could learn from her. And so I decided, well, I don't have a job at this time. I could have gone back into school and found another job if I wanted to. There were other offers. And I decided, you know what, this is my chance. I'm not locked into a job. I'm not in any relationships other than with my parents. And they're ready for me to leave. So let's do this. Let's go out there. I'll train with this, with my, who came to be my teacher, and learn and study. And it was the best decision that I ever made. It changed the way that I, it helped me to settle into myself, and to dig into the teachings of Buddhism, to dig into the teachings of Zen. So I have never regretted it. It of course has its hardships, but that's kind of how. So I stayed with my teacher for 6 years before. When I first came to my teacher, I had no intention of becoming a priest either, but I wanted to study. I wanted to understand myself more. And that's all, generally, you don't go to a teacher saying, hey, can you do this for me? that's what we do in the West, I think. We go to a teacher and say, hey, can you do this for me? Rather, in the Buddhist world, generally speaking, we go to a teacher and say, how can I serve you? What can I do for you? It's a different orientation. And it took me a while to figure that out. That was not immediately, I did want to learn from my teacher, but it took me a while to figure out, oh, wait a minute. It's not so much about how this person can give something to me. It's about how I can be of service to her. And once I switched that orientation around, things went a lot smoother. But one of the things that, my teacher said to me early on in the first year that I was with her, you could be a Buddhist priest if you wanted to be. And so I thought, oh, wow, yeah, I guess I could. I didn't know that that was an option. So maybe a few months later, I said, maybe I'll be a Buddhist priest. And she said, no, you're not ready yet. meanwhile, there's another person in the Zen center where I was at that was getting ready to ordain as a priest. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I got here before she did. She's ready to be a priest. Why can't I? My teacher said, no, you got it. You need to do some more work first. So I ended up, that was a big, what we call a koan for me. Like, why, what, okay, now I'm hooked. Now I'm hooked. I didn't really want to be a priest, but now I do. And but she's saying I can't be. All right, now I got to investigate this a little bit more. So my teacher asked me to train at other centers during this first 6 year period that I was with her. I went to Nebraska Zen Center. I went to Tassajara, trained with wonderful, excellent teachers at both places, and as well as teachers in the Rinzai Zen tradition, Syracuse Zen Center, and in the Theravadin tradition, Thich Nhat Hanh's community, and the monk from Sri Lanka, Bhante, his name's escaping me right now. Anyways, just amazing, amazing human beings to practice with. And then it started to really inspire me. I'm like, oh, wow, this is really a viable option for a livelihood. So I thought, okay, well, I can actually make this my livelihood, being a priest. And my teacher, I came back to her, and most of that first 6 years was with her, minus a year in California and Nebraska. And year after year, she said, no, you're not ready. And then finally, I thought, you know what? After 6 years, I thought, you know what? I don't actually need to do this. I don't need to, I don't need to try to strive to be a priest. I can just practice. I can just do this practice without the desire for any kind of badges. Like, this is a badge, right? This thing I'm wearing. It's a beautiful robe. It's a robe. And it means something. It has deep symbolic meaning, but it's also a kind of a badge that can be removed, right? And I realized, the real thing I need to do is just live my life fully, to be real, and to care for other people the best way I know how. and everything else is external. It's superficial. And once I came to that realization soon after, I didn't tell my teacher that, but I said, you know, I'd kind of dropped the idea altogether of being a priest. And then my teacher said, yeah, you know, if you want to be a priest, you could do that now. So then I thought, okay, all right, well, now that I let it go, it's returned to me. And it was a big lesson for me, you know, like if you really want something, you need to be earnest about it. First of all, you really do need to want it. It can't be like a superficial wanting. And then you really have to be able to let it go, even though you want it so much. That's how you know you really, if you really love something, and this is something Thomas Merton, I read, he's a Catholic monk, prolific writer, that lived in the 1960s and did a lot of dialogue between Catholic monks and Buddhist monks and Hindu monks. And he said something that I'll never forget. If you really love something and you let it go and it doesn't come back to you, then it was never yours in the first place. But if you love something deeply and you let it go and it comes back to you, it's always been yours. So there's no fear in letting go of what you love. If it's really yours, it will return. And so that was a big lesson for me. And it happened not on a head level, but on a visceral body level. So that was kind of my, you know, and then I continued to train with my teacher for the next 9 years. And so 15 years in living in a Zen temple. And it was good. It was, you know, very grateful. And one of the, you know, I mentioned cooking at the beginning. You know, I didn't have any experience cooking. Well, one of the first things that I had to learn how to do was how to cook, you know. I had to learn how to chop vegetables and, you know, cook rice. And you know, prior to that, all I knew was how to boil water and throw in a box of macaroni and heat up some cheese or tomato sauce. And that's about it. Now, and then after, you know, after that, starting to cook. And then I was cooking for first just my teacher and then for sometimes up to 30 people. So big change there.
Did you notice that the degree of suffering that you were experiencing led you to where you are today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
If suffering wasn't there, I wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
So we really do need to acknowledge suffering. And that's an alignment with the first noble truth of Buddhism, right? That all life is suffering, that life is that we suffer. So for me, yeah, suffering was very present in the form of anxiety, like existential anxiety, and also in relationship anxiety. At the time that I started to practice what I would call a formal meditation practice in college, it was at that same time that I was in a relationship with another college student, and it was a really, you know, it was a very, talk about you love somebody, but then you're forced to let them go, and then they don't come back, or sometimes they come back. You know, it's just your heart really gets wrenched in different directions, and for me, it was I couldn't deal with it. You know, I never ever wanted to be in that kind of a situation again. So I thought, well, you know, that was a big motivation for me to really get down to the heart of my own relationship issues. Like why did this happen to me? Why did this person treat me in such a way? And again, it's like flipping the lens. Instead of blaming the person, which is what we often do, instead of blaming the other person, it's like turning it around and saying, what did I do? How could I be a better person so that this kind of, I don't attract this kind of thing to me? Not thing. Sure, she was doing her own, having her own journey and maturation process that I wasn't even aware of, you know? And so we come into relationships when we're immature, we come into relationships thinking, oh, this person's going to do all these things for me and make me feel good. And as we mature, if we don't change that, that's the end of the relationship. We need to start thinking, or it, even if we are mature, it might be the end of the relationship. We need to change from thinking, what can this person do for me, to how can I serve this person better?
Yeah.
You know, it's just that shift.
Yeah, I noticed that is a central theme in Buddhism, is this reversal of what you can do for me, and now looking out what I can do for others, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I can do for others actually improves my condition.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And do you feel like your family setting, you know, when you entered college, you were obviously already searching, right? You were taking biology and religion and interested in finding out the truth. Not everybody has that a nature to really question whether or not what they've learned all their lives, is it true, is it false, and what does that mean for me? You know, some people go to college and they study economics, or they have this plan for their lives, and you know, they want to make money and they know how much money they're going to make at the end and who they're going to marry. And I'm like kind of like a lot like you. When I entered college, came from a Catholic family. I studied philosophy and religion early in college. Philosophy religion class really kind of wowed me and changed me. And I was a swimmer as well.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. But I didn't, I wasn't introduced to Zen teaching. Mm. And I, you know, it just wasn't introduced. I didn't know that was out there. And so, you know, I suffered for quite a long time, and I didn't know quite what to do with that suffering. But I did know that I wanted to search for kind of a deeper meaning, a deeper purpose in life, and how to contact that was escaping me for quite some time.
Yeah.
So when you started studying Zen, and you knew you were going to become a Zen priest, coming from Western values, what other shifts, counterintuitive shifts, were made for you?
Well, here's one thing, is that from a Western Christian perspective, you're either in or you're out.
And from a Buddhist perspective, there's no in or out. My teacher shared a story of a Westerner who went to practice in Japan at a Zen temple for some time, and maybe a few months or something. And at the end of his stay, he approached the head monk and asked him, you know, I really like this religion. How do I become a member? And the head monk scratched his head on the other side, indicating confusion in the question itself. Like, how do you become a member? And then he turned and he looked at the man and he said, how does a cloud become a member of the sky? So our birthright is enough. We're born into this world. We belong because we've been born here, not because we joined a club, not because I'm a Buddhist or because I'm a Catholic. That doesn't have anything to do with it. I belong because I'm here.
Yeah.
And there's no, you know, I don't have to prove something about it.
Yeah.
So that was somewhat eye-opening. I wasn't being asked to drop anything. And now I look back at that time. A lot of Buddhist teachers say to Westerners, you don't have to become a Buddhist, and that is so liberating. That's so liberating to hear that, right? And they'll often say, don't leave your
religious tradition. You know, if you're Christian, stay Christian and be a great Christian. I chose to take this path, but I feel very strongly that, you know, those Christianity, Catholicism, those are my religious roots. And you can't just, like, through an intellectual exercise, uproot yourself. They're there. You know, it informs the way that I think. Western society forms the way that I think. But then there is, and Western society also forms a lot now the way that Asians think too.
Yeah.
But then there is also these little pockets or puddles of communities that are still alive and out there that are living in a different kind of world. So the sense of community, for example, when I trained with my teacher, but then also having that reaffirmed going to Japan and training as a monk for close to a year's time in Japan, and learning the value of being a community member, where in the United States we have the philosophy to stand out, to stand up on your own two feet. These are important values, to make your mark, to be the rugged individual and to conquer the world. You know, we have the idols of Superman and Luke Skywalker and those, right, and battling evil and that kind of thing. But in a monastic setting, that does not hold up very well. Like, being the superhero doesn't work. In fact, you have to learn how to, what we call, fly with the flock. Just as you see these, you know, this time of year, the geese flying overhead in droves, and they make that V-shaped pattern, right? And it's learning to be in that pattern with other people, learning to notice your relationship between yourself and the other people in your group, and to fly accordingly. So, like, a school of fish, it's amazing. You see those videos of the schools of fish underwater, and they're all like, it's like one body moving, but you see a million different fishes there. And the same is true even on an individual level. We think we are an individual being, but we forget that we are like a collective school of fish, and it we have the appearance of one body, but if you look close enough on a biological level, we're trillions of cells here just swimming together.
Yeah.
And somehow we're there's some cohesion on a mental level that allows us to speak coherently and say one thing. But it's really trillions of things coordinating together, literally trillions of things coordinating together. So, you know, and then
we have the idea in the West of the individual actually existing. But from a Buddhist perspective, and this is across Buddhist schools, there is no inherent self, inherently existing self, which is really hard for us to get our minds wrapped around, because we're so schooled in thinking that we need to learn how to live independently, right? We don't have interdependent living. We have independent living. Our country didn't have a declaration of interdependence. We had a declaration of independence. And so it's just like, on so many levels, how do we become independent? This creates itself all kinds of anxiety. From swimming, as you know, it's not about cooperation, it's about competition. And I learned a lot about life through swimming competitively. But there's this big piece missing of I shouldn't say there's no cooperation, but and we have to learn how to navigate that, though. I wasn't very good at navigating that line between cooperation and competition. I think we need more there. When I recently came across a line from Confucius and the Analects of Confucius about learning how to do archery, where the archers, you talk about Zen and the art of archery. How do you're competing? Right? You're learning how to shoot to aim for the bullseye and get it right on the bullseye. And you're competing with other archers to do that. You know, this was the big
game back in, you know, 2,500 years ago. So, but on the way to the, on the way to the archery match, you're in a, in a, in a cooperative relationship with the people you're going to be competing against. And when you finish competing, there's again that cooperative relationship. And I think that gets overlooked a lot in sports that are very individualistic, like swimming. It's just like all about competition. We don't see the need. We don't see a need for cooperation there. As long as everything gets set up, we're good to go. But we're missing a little, the big piece of building relationships with people, building kind relationships, not, you know, because then we come away from our competitions thinking that we're actually better than somebody else if we win, or worse than somebody else if we lose. And that is out of sync with the way reality works. We live in a world of where everything works and evolves because of cooperation with others, not in spite of it. When we learn to work together, and that means we need to learn to drop our ego. We need to understand how our minds work, and see where we, put a mirror on our own. I hate to say it, but selfishness, where we think that we actually are more important than others or less important than others, as opposed to interbe with others, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, interbeing. Mm-hmm. We interrelate. That what happens to somebody else happens to me, whether they're in my family. We can really feel that, I think, on a familial level, but when it happens on a cultural, like a societal level, what happens to another community elsewhere, you know, unless we know them, we don't feel it. Another, yeah. What's that?
Oh, we're really disconnected the farther out the person is, yeah.
Certainly on the other side of the world, something's happened. And then this, you know, some of us are really porous and can feel that very deeply, even if it's somebody we don't know. And then there's this feeling of complete overwhelm. Like, there, that's the other side of it, is that, wow, like, what do? We know that we're so interrelated, and it's just overwhelming because we want to do so much for people because we see that interconnection. That's the other side. And that's not viable either. That's not a viable way. So how to have that balance between seeing the interrelatedness of things and at the same time taking care of what we can in a way that is, you know, considers the our own abilities, right? It considers the energy that we have this lifetime around.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm glad that you brought that up, because I really wanted to talk more about that. This disillusion of the ego, this sense of self that we have. In contextual behavioral science, of course, now in the ACT model, we have the self as context, right? So self as context is more of the fluid, the verbal self that is not a self of labels and judgments that we normally think of the I, like I am so-and-so, I do this, right? And judge each other accordingly. So they move in that direction, but we're still living in a kind of culture where is based on hierarchies, mm-hmm. right? So, certain people are given a lot more respect than others, but there's a disparity of wealth, large disparity of wealth in this country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a disparity of treatment, especially among people of color, and we've maintained poverty, consciously maintained poverty for years and years. And so when you're living within this culture, there seems to be, then it creates a conflation between this desire to create a self as context, a more fluid type of self, but yet we're actually still reinforcing that idea as self as content, the idea that we have we've earned our success, right? Or that we should be blamed and shamed for the wrong things that we do. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really sure that we're properly addressing it. And I'm wondering, like, how do you address that living in the West, studying Buddhism? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, well, the one thing that I heard you say is that we shame ourselves or shame others if, you know, for the place that they are in society, right? And so how do we deal with that? Well, I think on one level, just, you know, having this conversation is important part of it, to bring it up. You know, do you realize that there are segments of our population, I'm just maybe give a concrete example here. I'm just thinking of disparity, economic disparity between white people and people of color. Or you can also extend that to indigenous peoples. And I think we often don't realize that what happens in previous generations affects the way we are right now. And one way that we kind of whitewash the previous generations of what happened, like the traumas of previous generations, be it genocide of indigenous peoples or slavery, when we whitewash that and say, okay, well, now we're at a place where everybody's equal, the slaves have been freed, we're good now, you should be able to access everything you need. But then we don't look at policies. We don't look at the policies that have not just the prejudices of individuals that can keep people back, but the policies of our government that hold people back. And I'm not expert on this at all. I'm just discovering this for myself again and again. It seems like I can't hear it enough, but one of the things we do is certain days, one day of the month is dedicated to studying race. We look at there's a wonderful book out now called Black and Buddhist that I highly recommend. And I've been studying this in a class that I've been teaching, and I hope to get into it a lot more, but we have to look at how intergenerational trauma affects the present moment and the person that's sitting with us. And I think on a wide scale, we don't look at, as a country, we don't recognize trauma. I mean, here we are, United States, and I didn't learn about the genocide that took place here on this soil until I took an elective class in college on Native Americans. And I was completely shocked because I had this narrative of Columbus doing this heroic thing and the Thanksgiving feast and the pilgrims and all of that. I think it's a little bit becoming more aware now, but when I was growing up, man, that was the image I had. So learning about how Native peoples were treated and how Columbus himself looked at them, I was just like, wow, that's the way. Oh, and then, okay, and then they live in, they're pushed to reservations, some, and unless you know, I mean, it's complex. It's not just this black and white picture that I'm painting, but you have the influx, you have the government pressures and military pressures pushing the Native peoples to various reservations. You also have the complexities of missionaries, Christian missionaries trying to convert the heathens, to make them more European-like and this kind of thing. You know, that this took place over centuries, and the acculturation, you know, I don't even call it acculturation, but this kind of demeaning of a culture, and then expect somebody to live functionally in the society is it's not realistic. Right. And the same for you know, I don't want to say that people with trauma can't like build, don't have great resolve. I think they have incredible resources. Some are able to tap into their own inner strength and be amazing human beings despite their trauma, or maybe because of it. I don't know. But there's a large degree that we're unconscious or don't recognize intergenerational trauma. I don't even want to recognize it in myself. It's not something that we like to think about. Like, oh, I have, you know, because we don't want anybody. It's the word I'm thinking of. We don't want to think of ourselves as weak in any way or having been hurt in any ways. There's shame in that.
Yeah.
So how to like break or to make it okay to start seeing the pain that not just we as individuals have gone through, because maybe it's not so much. I can say that I have had a very loving upbringing in many ways, but we can't just like dismiss, be too, I think we're overly dismissive of our history. You know?
I think that has a lot to do, or very similar to, our degree of avoidance of dealing directly with our past, because it is very painful. And so why not consciously fuse with some narrative that gives us this this hero complex? Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many people, you know, in the United States would say, the U.S., this is the greatest country in the world. And it's always this hurrah about the United States. We can do anything together and we're the greatest thing. And it seems like this is a total wash of the tragedies that we have caused in the past and are still causing today. Mm-hmm. And race and economics and just the social ills that we have or just go unrecognized. Mm-hmm. And we have these simple stimuli that, like the Dow Jones, if the Dow Jones is doing well, that means that everybody's living well.
Right.
Yeah. And it just makes things very simple to continue to avoid the trauma that's currently going on and past trauma that's going on.
Yeah, it's kind of like recently I saw the movie The Matrix.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like that. We're living in this. We think we're actually living, and then we take the red pill and we realize, oh wait a minute, I'm just being used.
Yeah.
You know, wake up out of this. Oh, there's a whole other thing here going on.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of the real world that we live in. As there's a big waking up process that I think is going on. It's taking place, but you know, we have to keep at it. So yeah. for Buddhist practices, we can look and notice, like, for example, when we're practicing meditation, there's the practice of seeing within yourself your ancestors. Mm-hmm. Right. And just kind of noticing that I am not here based on my own merit only, but because of the ancestors from my past, my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and you know, you can keep going back. And here, it's important, I think, also to recognize how we've been culturally made white. So my Italian ancestors, it came from, my great-grandmother came from Sicily when she was a kid. My I had a great great grandfather come from Ireland when he as an adult brought his family along. So those two, you know, my Irish side, my Sicilian side, they've been whitewashed, right? And I'm not in touch with the culture, my cultural roots, because now I've made it to being white. You know, and this process of becoming white, this is something I'm just learning. Is something that a lot of white people have had to do in order to to do well in the United States. We have to become white, in a sense.
Right, right.
So we let, so by practicing looking at, you know, who are our ancestors? Where did we come from? They spoke different languages, right? And recognizing that, that's part of who I am too. So anyways, those are just some thoughts that come to my mind.
Yeah, it's a very deep subject. You know, we're living in a country that is, as you had said before, is very individualistic. And we pride ourselves on individual achievements. And then we attribute those to psychological states of, like, you know, perseverance and sacrifice and, you know, motivation, all this kind of stuff that, you know, these, what we assume are freely chosen behaviors, right? And so, of course, if you haven't achieved what I have achieved, and you know, the whole measure of what constitutes success. And it concerns me on a couple of, I want to ask your opinion on this, is, you know, when I take, there's a difference between when I take an ACT training, acceptance commitment therapy, and really get into the behavioral processes and really starts clicking with me, it can click with me on an intellectual level. But when I attended the Zen at Appomattox Zen, at the Zen Center, and we started saw Zen, if you can explain a little bit more about that after, it was just, it was a completely different experience for me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't me having to learn anything or analyze anything. It was me experiencing silence for a long time with a group of other people, and just, I felt so accepted and warm in that community. That was a big difference. The structure, the hierarchical structure that we live in, and or the psychological community is very much self-defeating, in my opinion. But when we get into those, when I got introduced to Zen meditation, very different and accepting experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I think is the foundation for Zen practice is, and we don't necessarily say it explicitly, but I'm going to say it explicitly, and that is there is unconditional love when we sit in meditation, when we sit in Zazen. There is the experience of unconditional love, and that just meaning that we're, whoever we are, whatever we have done, whatever we feel about ourselves, we are unconditionally accepted. And you don't have to put a name next to who it is that unconditionally accepts us. It's just that we are unconditionally loved by, maybe you want to say, the universe. It's not one person, because people don't do it. But we can feel it, right? When we give ourselves an opportunity to sit in silence and stillness. Now, that unconditional love can be manifested in other ways as well. And for a lot of people, silence and stillness does not work. That's something that I've come to learn the hard way, is that just in working with. So one of the things I started doing when I was in training at the temple was offering yoga and meditation for people in a drug and alcohol rehab. And I realized that silence and sitting still might not be the most effective means for folks who are coming off of drugs. And for some people, it might be. It might be exactly what they need, but it's not like a universal thing that's going to do it for everybody. And so we have to recognize, I think, that, you know, I might feel this way, but is that the case for the person sitting next to me? And we also have to recognize that at this time in my life, this fits right. This feels right.
there's something that fits really well for me at this time, but it doesn't mean it's always going to be that way either. So just some thoughts on that. I think the Zen center that you connected with is really good with the kind of flattening of hierarchical structures. But, you know, I think just we have to keep an eye on that, because even in, you know, Zen Buddhism comes from a society, a culture that's highly hierarchical. And so if you practice someplace like in Japan, you would find, you know, you might have a wholly totally different view about Buddhism. It'd be like, well, I think I'll leave that at the door. but we do have to work on, we have to, you know, you mentioned hierarchy, and there's a place for it if it's if there's real compassion from the top. But if there's lacking any compassion from the top, it defeats itself, like you said. It's self-defeating if there's no compassion. And so we strive here in at our place here at Zen Fields and Ames, we strive to make this as much a community operation as much as possible. You know, I hesitated to start something myself because I didn't want it to come from me. I wanted it to be coming from other people, that hey, we want to have a Zen center here. And I've been in Ames, Iowa for now 6-7 years, and people have been slowly saying, hey, don't you want to have something? And I'm like, well, is this something you're interested in doing? And we're just slowly starting to kind of gather the gravitational pull of a star kind of starts to pull us together on its own. So it has to be something that comes organically, not from one person doing everything. I hear you on that whole, when we see somebody as above us and ourselves as below, we have to be careful. There's in some ways, there's no way to escape it.
Yeah.
We want, there's some part of it. There's some part of us that in our maturation process, as we mature, we need to see somebody who's above us and beyond us, like a Buddha. Mm-hmm. And to be able to approach them, that's how we grow. But then we also need to be able to, like the Zen koan says, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha. But we have to be careful. It doesn't mean that literally, right? We don't go out killing people. it's to remind us to not get caught up in that view of the person as somehow better or other. And that's what the Buddha taught. That's really the heart of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha was a human being, and because he was a human being, he gives us the inspiration to be awakened.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to conflict with our teachers. We need to be able to disagree with our teachers. But this is easier said than done, I think.
Yeah.
You know, especially we don't realize on an unconscious level, we're working on an unconscious level, and when we are with a teacher, training with a teacher, that's there's archetypes, you know, those archetypes are coming forward, teacher-student relationship. So it brings all of us to our whole self into that relationship.
When, you know, it draws an interesting question, because as a Buddhist priest, you find a pressure that people put on you, that you, that they see you as some kind of demigod, that you ought to be better than, a set the very high moral standard all the time, that as if mm-hmm. you don't have these human fallibilities, or you can't express them anyway, or if you do, it's got to be within that, you know, that centered Buddhist kind of way. Is that an extra pressure for you?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And this is a problem that I think is for clergy across the board, yeah. Whether they're Buddhist or Christian or Jewish, or, you know, that we all have to struggle with this, because we're trained and we're taught to be very humble and not to see ourselves in that light. And yet, once we're in a certain position, it's inevitable that you're seen in that light. So now you have to deal with it, you know? So, and there is training that I've done to kind of become conscious of it. Because if we're not, we can create a lot more suffering.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking, you remember Tiger Woods had that scandal back in the day, and it was at the height of his career, and people were like, oh my gosh, and the media broke out, like as if this demigod from golf actually, where this angel fell down from the sky. And I'm thinking, he was just a great golfer. I mean, give him a break. He's not, right? But you're in a position, though, right. that's completely different, that where people actually now look up to you for to set the moral standard and to be the teacher and a guider. And so, you know, if you're carrying groceries from the car and eggs drop and you drop the F-bomb in the neighborhood and, you know, your neighbor hears, is that a scandal? Is that, I mean, right. how do you properly address that?
Right. And I think we are definitely all humans. And this is where, for me, seeking a therapist is really important. You know, I see a therapist when I need to. Yeah. I have friends that I can reach out to and have conversations with. I have my own colleagues that I'm in relationship with. And we can talk about stuff that, you know, we've had to put up with, the BS here and there. And some of my family too, I can talk with. I talk with my brother. He gives me great advice. My brother has given me some of the greatest advice throughout my lifetime. I'm very blessed, you know? So we have these people in our lives that help to humanize us. And you know, if we stay isolated, that's the worst place to be.
Yeah.
Because anybody is fallible and can get sucked into thinking that, into believing. We have to be aware of the projections that other people have on us. And that's where it gets sticky. We also have counter projections, counter transference. Somebody might see me as something great, and then I believe it. You know, those are, so there's ways to deal with that and work with it. And it's a normal part of the process, right? So I don't want to shame anybody for projecting onto me. I think that's another part of the issue, is when we think, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. That's what people do. We need to recognize it and work with it with some compassion.
Yeah. And moving on to a very important topic that's related, you know, it seems to me, you know, if we draw that kind of metaphor of say, learning about a frog, right? Here in the West, we're very good at dissecting the frog, right? Knowing all the parts and knowing how everything works together. Does that then create a problem when we're thinking about what a frog is? So do you feel like the science, if we say too much in the science and the analytical part of ourselves, there's a danger there, and then we're missing the bigger picture?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, boy, the analogy you just gave is part of the reason why I couldn't continue studying biology. As I when I was in my was junior year in college, and we were asked to actually kill a frog. It was still alive. And I hate to say it, but I had to cut its head off.
Yeah.
And I love frogs.
Yeah.
I had frogs for pets when I was growing up. And here I saw these beautiful frogs in a box, and they were swimming around. I thought, oh, they're so beautiful. I had to hold the frog and cut its head off with a scissor. I you know what? That killed something in me when I did that. And I thought, this is the end of my studying of biology. I did it. I from that point forward, I started studying ecology. Because, yeah, I think we miss the bigger picture. So on a very literal level, we miss the bigger picture when we're just getting into, and it,
you know, what kind of heart is required to kill something in order to learn about it? You've killed yourself in a sense. If that's what we need to do to study something is to kill it. And I'm speaking literally, but also figuratively here. We're killing something in ourselves, and it's not, we're no longer studying what we want to study because it's dead. Now we've missed the bigger picture. So how to bring us out as a society, bring us out and get us into the whole, right? The whole picture, I think is really, really important for our future, our collective future.
Yeah.
Seeing things in terms of whole. I think it's important to go, you know, to narrow down and get close to things. And sure, if we are saving lives in the process of taking the lives of rats or something, then you could probably make an ethical case for it. But I don't know if we think that deeply about it all the time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your.
It does, you know, in a sense. This is how I was taught to think about behavior change. There's the fundamentals of behavior change. You break it down into component parts, and you kind of test what works and what doesn't work to create the change that you want to see. And it occurred to me that there's a really deep confusion in that podcast that we saw at Evolution Psychology with Hayes, Church, and Gilbert. They were talking a lot about, we need to work with evolutionary science to create the context and promote these pro-social ways of living now that we know how behavior works, right?
Hmm.
But when we, the contradiction for me is, if we're not really egos, right? If we're not individualized selves, how are we then to properly conceive of behavior? That are we thinking of conscious control as a way of forcing ourselves into nature to create change, or conscious control more of being aware of where we are and allowing behavior to, with compassion, right? And allowing behavior to take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things I liked about the way that in that particular podcast they were talking about evolution was the idea that whether you are like God-centered or evolutionary-centered, you could still, you know, we have to get kind of beyond those distinctions. And so when we're talking about our own minds, that we are in charge of our evolution, to me that kind of makes a lot of sense from a Buddhist meditative perspective. Because we can come to see our own failings through the practice of meditation. We come to see how we fail and how we fall. That's a very important insight to have about ourselves right there, just to see that. And then we can also, here's the thing where I think science can also help kind of these meditative studies, is that we're in charge of our own evolution in the sense that through our behaviors, we turn genes off and on. That's pretty amazing to me. Like, oh, you know, I know there's genes that my own ancestors have been, you know, there is a lot of anger and a lot of rage. Not only from hearing stories of past ancestors like my great grandfather, but also experiencing it in my own body at times, like absolute anger and rage. Like, where is that coming from?
Yeah.
Well, it's from me, but it's also embedded in my DNA. Yeah. Well, now, okay, I have a practice that I can
become more aware of it. Doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, be perfect and never angry, but I can become aware of, oh, this is anger, and I can choose how to respond to it in a way that might be more skillful, and in that way breaking the chain of suffering, which is what the Buddha taught about. So how do we break free of this world of suffering, this world of samsara? It's by recognizing our cravings and our grasping at things. We want things to be a certain way, and we don't want them to be another way. So how do we cut, you know, that hand that grasps? And that, I think, is, you know, maybe we can make an argument that that is where we're capable of actually evolving ourselves, kind of taking the hold of evolution itself, and you know, taking responsibility for our own evolution. I kind of like that idea. It kind of blends science and religion in a way that's practical, that we can actually, you know, do for ourselves, right? Because, you know, evolutionary science by itself, it seems very remote, I think, for a lot of people. Oh, okay, there's these species, and now all of a sudden we have human beings evolved from apes, but where do we go now? Well, now we're in charge of this process. Not that we're God in any sense, but we have some say as to which genes we want to turn off and on based on how aware we are. That's a huge responsibility. And I think that's where I think we need to go as a society. So that part, I think that's an important part of what they were talking about. But it sounded like you saw something else there.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, and I agree with that. I think that there is a danger of conflation between what's considered hubris on our part, that we control it. We got this, right? Like that's the grasping that you were talking about.
Yes.
That's not really well defined. And the kind of control, or the sense of control, that just comes from simple awareness and developing those compassionate processes.
Yeah.
And then allowing behavior, in a sense, to take care of itself.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear where you're coming from. Yeah, I could see there. And this is where science really needs to benefit. Like, these scientists need to benefit from doing some practice themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Because we are, yeah, from that sense, I have to be really careful what I say too, because saying that I'm in control, that, you know, in the next second, I could lose that control.
Right.
It doesn't matter if I've been meditating for 50 years, I can lose that control. Yeah. And so actually, another way of thinking of practice is that we let go of control. We let go of trying to control anything. We let go of trying to control our anger, trying to be happy, trying to be joyful. I'm not saying we shouldn't try to do those things, but the trying comes in when we're letting go of trying. That's where the effort.
Yeah. I don't think that people a lot of people understand that, and certainly like that jumbles around my brain, and when I think I've got it, I don't. So could you talk a little bit more about that, just
Absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of us, I think maybe all of us, when we're coming to, so I'll just talk about meditation, because that's where I'm familiar with this, but what I've noticed is that a lot of us, including myself, we come to meditation with the idea that we are going to change, that we are going to do the changing. And that's a problem. That really is a problem. Again, it's going back to that shift of what can this do for me versus how can I serve? That's the fundamental shift that needs to take place. We need to change from asking the question, oh, I'm going to change, versus how can I make the world a better place, or what can I do to serve others? If we start from that place, everything else takes care of itself. And then we start to, we have to be able to, I think, open and listen to guidance, whether it's from a a trusted teacher or from the universe. We have to be open to guidance here. And that might mean, that might look like defeat. It might look like grief. I can't understate how much we need to grieve. Grieving is a letting go process. It's a process of releasing and not being in control. It's allowing ourselves to be out of control in a sense. Not, you know, and that sounds scary, I think, for a lot of people. And it is, it can be very scary to feel like you're out of control. But if we can go into our bodies, allow ourselves to feel the grieving that is there, then we might find ourselves in a very stable place, much stabler than any mental control that we can have over our mind.
Yeah.
Now, if we can drop into our grief, there's a statement, there's a, in the book of Ecclesiastes, so chapter 7 of the book of Ecclesiastes in the Hebrew Bible talks about it's better to enter the house of mourning than to enter the house of joy, because in mourning, that's where you will learn. That's where your spirit will learn. Mm-hmm. And we need to do that individually and collectively as a culture. We need to learn how to mourn. We need to allow ourselves, give ourselves time to grieve in whatever way that we feel comfortable doing. But we need the permission to do it. From others, from our workplaces, from our families. We need to give people permission to grieve. We need to understand what grieving is and the process of that for others, so that we don't try to make them into something that they're not. Grieving is ugly, and we're in this adolescent phase, I think, as a culture. It's an ugly duckling phase that we're in right now, and we need to like give people the space to be ugly.
Grieving, just quickly define, what does grieving mean for you?
So, well, on a very physical level, the ability to shed tears profusely, you know, just the ability to be able to let the tears run and not be shamed for it, not to think that there's something wrong with you, to allow that. But it could mean allowing yourself to feel on a bodily level, low energy.
Yeah.
Right. And we're the culture that says you should never be unhappy, and you should always have energy, good, feel good kind of thing. Well, what if we can be okay? What if we can feel good about not feeling good? Right. I think that's where practice comes in. I'm not saying we should wallow in grief. That's not what I'm saying. Because practice is about transforming suffering, but I think we overlook it and we try to bypass it. See, this is where spiritual practice is tricky, because we try to bypass our suffering and jump to enlightenment. Like, yeah. If I just do this thing, everything's going to be good. But reality is that's we're just bypassing our real state. And so the work, this kind of spiritual practice, is coming into seeing, what are we actually feeling? What am I feeling right now in my body? And maybe that looks like numbness. Maybe I don't feel anything. Well, that's something that's helpful use information to say, like, I don't notice anything. All right, well, that's a great place to start. I think that's where a lot of people are. Again, and so we think we're supposed to feel something like enlightened, or maybe feel really sad. Well, maybe we don't feel any of that. Well, shit, we're living in a time where species are going extinct at the rate of the dinosaurs were 65 million years ago. That should give us something to feel a little bit frightened about. And if we're not feeling anything, okay, well, that's a good place to start. Like, what's going on there? And coming into honesty, like, wow, I'm, you know, being more honest with how we're, you know, being more honest with ourselves.
Boy, it really does bring up a lot of good points. You know, when I sit in meditation, my brain is racing and always thinking all the things that I need to do and what, you know, and I sometimes wonder what is the purpose of just sitting here and doing nothing for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. We'll kind of leave on that, but what, on Sazen, right? Is that how you say it? What does that do for you? And how does that create behavior change?
This is a good question, right? Oh man. Well, like I mentioned earlier, when I first came to do Zazen, I felt better.
Yeah.
You know, I connected with something on a pre-verbal level that I hadn't been able to connect with before. And so that's there. Not everybody connects with meditation or Zazen immediately like that, though. I look back at it now, I think I was fairly lucky to have that kind of an experience early on. But another thing to consider with Zazen is that we don't do Zazen. Zazen does us. And that's where the letting go comes in. So we think that if we think we're doing Zazen, we're already off base. We're not doing it. You know, if we think that I'm consciously putting there's some level of us that is doing, like, is deciding. We have to make a decision and decide to sit. But once we're there sitting, it's not, we have to let go of this idea that I'm doing this. That's really this kind of central piece. And this is where, I even hesitate to say that, though, because there's places for other practices within Zazen where it's where you are directing your attention to certain places or certain things. So this is a tricky question. And for anybody that's trying to meditate and figure it out, I think you cannot do it easily on your own. You've got to have some instruction from a teacher, because it really depends on where you are in your life. There's things that, like I just said, now I'm actually starting to feel regret that I already said you don't do Zazen, because actually that may not be helpful for everybody. But I think, yeah, I have to be really careful about giving any advice on, you know, just like to the general public like that, because it just really depends on where a person is in their life and what practices might be appropriate. They change too. And so what works now might be okay for some people some of the time, but then, so yeah, I don't know. I'd have to, you know, what does it do? You're coming back to your, what does it do for me? That's a question I have to keep coming back to. But one of the things I'll say is that we try to keep what's called don't know mind. And that means that we stay open and curious to our life as a whole, or not just our life, but life itself. And to keep the question in our mind as much as possible, what is my life about? What is this life about? Why am I here? And so meditation, Zazen helps us to hold that question. It brings us to the place of looking at the mystery, or looking at the mystery of life, like staying with that, the unusualness of being alive in the 21st century, at this time and this place, right? The unusualness of being alive. I mean, we overlook the gift of life until it's like right in our face and we might lose our life. But what Zazen can do is bring us closer to the reality of the unusualness of being alive.
Yeah.
Right? I wouldn't say that to just anybody, though, because not everybody is in a place that, you know, they're just trying to survive. And but again, you know, I say something and I'm like,
Well, you know, it occurred to me when you were talking, you know, part of me hears, well, that's all fine and good, but how does that create a more functional life for me in the real world? Does that translate well my everyday practice?
Right. And this is where working with other people, working with a community, yeah, working with a teacher can be really invaluable, because we don't see ourselves by ourselves. We see ourselves when we're in community, and each member of a community is like holding up a mirror to ourselves, saying, oh, this is who you are.
Yeah.
Some of the best lessons I learned was when we were in retreat and working together in the kitchen, or working at, or eating a meal together. And then we see our egos actually come up in community, not necessarily when we're just working on ourselves in our own little corner, sitting in meditation. That's not, to me, that's not Zazen. Zazen is embedded in a communal life. And we see ourselves, we see our ego come up, and how we relate to people when we're in relationship, not when we're by ourselves.
Right.
So it's sometimes important to sit by yourself. I don't want to say we shouldn't, but it's in relationship in a community setting that's doing a similar or the same practice that we really get to see who we are.
Yeah.
And that could be your family. You know, your partner probably sees you better than you see yourself sometimes, or your children or your siblings can give you a pretty good insight about yourself. That's why I refer to back to my brother. You know, or my wife, she'll tell me,
yeah,
she'll give me some good ideas who I am.
Also a Zen Buddhist priest.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 She's pretty sharp there.
All right. I want to be respectful of your time. Can you now, I hate to put you on the spot, leave us something so profound it blows all our minds? Go.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I think the just loving ourselves is enough. Maybe it's just real plain, just really, really plain. Just care for yourself as best you can. Take good care of yourself. And develop compassion for those that are around you in your immediate neighborhood. Care for them, and take care of those in whatever way you can that are beyond your physical location, right?
Yeah.
So start with yourself, love yourself, and then once you feel settled there, go to your family and be with your family, and love your family as much as you can. And when you can't, go back to yourself and love yourself, and then go back to your family and do your best to love them. And in your workplace, do your best to be kind and compassionate, acknowledging the good work of others before you wish your own work to be acknowledged. I think that's key. Acknowledge the good work of others even before you get your good work acknowledged. And then just do your best.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being with me today. It was a real pleasure meeting you.
Well, likewise, Hugh, I enjoyed this conversation very much. It's what I live for. I love having these kind of conversations. So I'm really honored. I'm honored that you asked me. And I wish you all the best of success with this, with your work. You know, that to me, it's so important, taking care of folks behaviorally. So
yeah, Yeah.
I wish you all the best with that. We need more people like you.
No, with the same. So I wish you all the best. And tell us what the bow represents, why the bow is so significant.
Oh, sure. So when we bring our palms together and bow in the Buddhist tradition, it means that there's no separation between self and other. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what the palms coming together means. It's not necessarily a supplication, but we bring our palms together, the right and the left joined together as one, black and white joined together as one, up and down. These are just distinctions that we make in our mind, us and them, or me and you. These are just distinctions of reality. We are one. And so to bow to that oneness, it's to acknowledge I see myself in you, and I see you and me.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Again, thanks for inviting me, and I hope to talk again soon.
Yes, I'm sure we will. All right, take care.
All right, you too. Spit on the ground, hold your breath, try to scare yourself to death. Bury your bones under the dirt and tear at your heart and rip your shirt and stomp your feet in disgust. Curse the gray skies if you must, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone. And dig up your wine, break your heart, and give up the race before you start. Drop your drawers and roll around, burn your house right to the ground. Go to sleep, your head, screaming till your face is red, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone. Blue skies, setting sun, cherry pie.